Addiction is very real, and addiction is very deadly. But recovery is real too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's for anybody that wants it. And I believe this too. There's multiple. No two people, in my opinion, enter addiction exactly the same way, and no two people's addiction carries out the same way.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's multiple pathways to recovery.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Most High Show. I'm your host, Christian, and with me today is Sarah with an H.
Hello, hello.
And sitting in the decadent seat of service is Jeff Breedlove.
Hello. Hello.
We have an in-studio audience hanging out, eating a bunch of pizza, drinking LaCroix, like
the sober folks
good
do.
Sober individuals. And Leslie's doing quality control, and my man Joseph's running the ones and twos tonight for his first time. So tonight, we're going to be talking to Jeff about what he does, why he does what he does, why what he does and who he does it with is important. And I think it's going to be interesting. So Jeff is a person in long-term recovery who knows that recovery is real. He serves as the chief of policy and communications for the Georgia Council for Recovery. That'd mean watch him out, Chad, back there. Okay. Whenever I see that word council, I think, okay, something serious has happened. Previously, this is what's cool. Previously, he was a member of the international relations community and built relationships on a global scale. I'd love to hear a little bit about that. Sure. I'm sure it's part of your story. And this line at the end is like, his greatest joy and highest title are held as dad and husband. Amen. Welcome, Jeff, to the Most High Show. I love that like last line there, because you could do good in the world, but if those people you're entrusted to serve and build and grow with, and you don't do that well, it kind of like, right?
Right. You know, I'm Jeff Breedlove of Personal Long-Term Recovery, and my active addiction, it lasted 30 years. Mm. Basically from the time I was 20 years old until I was arrested in a very public fashion at 50. Now, I didn't do drugs every day for 30 years, but I had my counselors. I went to MAR for treatment here in DeKalb County, and I talked to them about what was my journey like so I could learn. And there were basically three phases to my active addiction. In the beginning, and I am old, and I remind people in all seriousness that when I started my journey into active addiction, we didn't have smartphones. And there wasn't instant tracking and instant messaging. And I learned how to lie and manipulate and tell people, oh, I'll be in this city an hour away, and I'll be up there for 2 hours, and it'll take an hour to get back. Well, that's 4 hours. And back then, that was common. You'd just be off the grid, and nobody thought anything about it. Nobody instant messaged you. Nobody tracked your phone.
Right.
So it was very, very different when I started. And that phase lasted until basically I lost my first job to the disease, tried to outrun the disease. That didn't work. And then I stopped using drugs for 7 years. And my wife and I thought I was cured and I was better. Mm-hmm. And yay me. Well, I wasn't, because it lasted 7 years. And then the last 11 years, in my opinion, were the most dangerous. I'd binge once a year for 2 or 3 days. So I got out of hand with money and guns, and the whole thing was not a good situation. But during that time, a couple of things happened, to go to your point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife and I just celebrated 30 years of marriage.
Yeah.
Also. Wow. And
she went through all of it.
She didn't leave me. She didn't give up on her marriage. She's a victim of my disease as much as anybody. Addiction's a family disease. Mm-hmm. It impacts far more people than just the primary person. But she stood strong in her faith. She stood strong in her marriage. She stood strong in her friendship with me. And, you know, if she were sitting next to me, she'd say, look, it was a close-run thing many times. But we have endured. And I think that's what a friendship is and a marriage is. And in the middle of all of that, we were blessed to adopt our son, Jack. And, you know, Jack is my proof that God is real. Mm. And, you know, good for you for getting me emotional in the first 30 seconds of the show. you know, I think in all seriousness, I don't think, for me, I should say use an eye for it. I found out, especially those last 11 years, that I could not recover for a job, for a hobby, like I love to travel or I love baseball. I couldn't recover for those things. I couldn't recover for my marriage, and I couldn't recover for my son. Recovery is a very personal situation.
Mm-hmm.
You can only recover, I think, for yourself. As important as everything else is, a job, a family, hobbies, you have to recover for you. So when I started to love myself, believe in myself,
mm-hmm.
and get healthy for myself, that's when I could be a better husband and a better father and a better friend and a better worker and coworker. So recovery taught me how to be actually both a healthy person.
Mm-hmm.
There was a counselor at Maury still there. His name is Todd Valentine. And mm-hmm. Todd walks around the halls at Maury. Now, Maury is segregated out, one campus for men, one for women, right?
Okay.
So you got a bunch of men, not at their best. And we got this guy walking up and down the hall saying, "You're a person worthy of love and to be loved." Hmm. I thought he was an idiot. And it annoyed me.
Right, here we go.
What is all this stuff?
Yeah.
And then, and I was at Maury for a very, very, very long time.
Mm.
And some months into that, I began to believe, well, that's true, but it's true for those guys, not me.
Mm-hmm.
So while I'm at Maury, speaking of family, they knocked on the door one day and pulled me out of a session. Maury just does not do that. I knew I hadn't broken any rules, so I'm like, what's up? Well, they told me that my father had suffered a heart attack and was he was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so the last time I ever saw my father alive was at the dinner the night before I checked in to Maury. So my father on earth, now I believe he's in heaven. I'm a Christian. Christ is my higher power, and my father is a believer. I believe he's in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But that aside for a minute, here on earth at the human level, my father never saw me go through treatment and recovery. I never got to talk to him about his role in my life story and the trauma in my life, and we never got to reconcile with each other. So I tie all that together to say, for me, family is a big part. It was a big part of my addiction, and it's a big part of my recovery. And if I would say anything to anybody watching this, it's forgive yourself. You are a person worthy of love and to be loved. You do matter.
Yeah.
And there's people that love you. Your higher power loves you. And once you believe in yourself, then you can be there for others in a way that matters to them, in a way that I couldn't understand in active addiction.
Now, let's go back to this once a year binge thing, though.
Yeah. Two or three days once a year, that was it?
So my wife kept a journal the last 11 years.
Uh-huh.
So it's like the premise for a
book.
Was
it the same time of year?
It was an average of 10 to 11 months. So, yes, it was basically in the fall. And, you know, the counselors told me I was just keeping all those feelings repressed inside and bottled up.
Holding out for the time when you could release and escape everything and be you for a minute.
Right.
Yeah.
And, look, I put myself and my wife and my mom in some pretty serious situations where I would ask to be bailed out financially, and my mom would come pay off a debt, and there'd be a gun put in her face until the business was transacted. I've learned to work past the shame of active addiction and all that, and I worked on reconciliation and things, but in the real world, you know, the values that I was living were could have had serious consequences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like, because I imagine like binging is kind of like holding out. Let me hold it together. And then when I let loose, I'm going to let loose.
Oh, when so, I let loose at the end, I let loose.
Right. So then there's these very extreme during that binge, there's a lot of extreme behavior mm-hmm. things going on. But people might justify the binging because, well,
we hardly ever do it.
Yeah.
It's a special. Oh. It's my little treat.
Yeah. It's my treat. I do this all year. I'm good.
I deserve this.
Yeah. And that's how I was on Friday night. And then it was like Tuesday morning, you know, so.
Right. Friday night, Tuesday morning. Well, my primary counselor, Mara, and I talked about, so I was so sick that on the one hand, my arrogance was off the charts. Like in a meeting, I would think I'm the smartest guy in the room and I've got all the answers. At the same meeting, at the same time, my insecurity was so off the charts that I was like, I'm going to say one thing wrong and they're just never going to invite me back to another meeting right. again. And I'm just...
That's that egomaniac with an inferiority complex.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So sometimes I would go out on these binges because I was feeling insecure and low. But ironically, the time that I got arrested, October of 2016, it was a Friday morning when I went out, and I thought I deserved a little bit. Now, this is 11 years into this last part of this cycle, and that's how powerful addiction is and the disease is. Intellectually, you know, objectively, academically, I could go, the last 10 times, this has ended this way.
Yeah.
But at that moment in time of my disease,
yeah.
This is what I think is hard for some people in society to understand about our disease. It's a brain disease.
Yeah.
And it's a brain disease that's intertwined with the emotions of usually childhood trauma. It's a very complex disease. And people don't understand what we're going through in our disease. But for me, on that Friday in October, I was ready to reward myself. And it goes to the international point. So this is how cunning and baffling the yeah. disease can be. I was blessed at that point in time. I was hosting 4 international delegates for the U.S. Department of State from 4 different countries who were doing these extended programs in Atlanta.
On this Friday morning.
Oh, well, they were here for weeks, and this was in the middle of their visit. And I was going to leave my work event with the commissioner I was working for and go hang out with them for the rest of the day. We had a wonderful day planned around Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And that Friday night, my son was playing a high school football game. But at that moment in time with my disease, all that was out the window.
So, but in that, so you're talking about in that moment, like, but you hadn't used or participated in anything for a while.
For the better part of a year.
Up to that point.
Right.
Do you feel like, because you said like you deserved it, do you think the active use or was it the non-active use, which one was your punishment?
That's a great question. I would say at that point in time, if I was being honest with myself, I guess the non-active use, like, because there was still a part of me that wanted, I hadn't accepted that it really was a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I hadn't really even learned about it, hadn't received any kind of clinical treatment or peer treatment or anything. So I guess I was a little bit angry at the world that I couldn't do that thing I wanted to do. Like, why is the thing that I liked always end in utter destruction?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, so I guess I was pretty angry at the whole world.
Because that's like, you know, when people say like, oh, you got to treat your ism. You know, if you're not imbibing, but you're still that person who would.
Yeah.
And so, and I think like, I mean, not that it's great that you were like, went really hard for a few days once a year, but it's still like, it wasn't daily.
Oh,
but here you are still with, mixed in with people who were daily, people who were bingers, people who, you know, there are other people who are just those once a year people. It's what it means, not how often you do it.
Yeah. I think you're probably the first person we've had on that binging was kind of part of their process, you know? And to your point of like the treating the ism. So the those months that you're not using, right? You're still just as sick.
Oh, absolutely. Quite right.
And you know, like you've heard it say, like drugs were the solution to the problem, right? Like people we use it because of whatever's inside of us we want relief from. So here's this, most of the year, you're not getting any relief.
Oh, no. And what's really sad about my disease, our disease, is during those days and weeks and months that I was completely sober, I would go to work. My wife and I would go do very, very, very fun things, whether it was just hiking or going to a Braves game or wherever we were traveling. But I wasn't really enjoying it. I was doing it, but I wasn't living it. I wasn't enjoying it.
Yeah.
And that is the difference. And again, you know, maybe somebody watches this that's thinking, should I give this recovery thing a try? Is it really real? The answer is this. Addiction is very real, and addiction is very deadly. But recovery is real too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's for anybody that wants it. And I believe this too. There's multiple. No two people, in my opinion, enter addiction exactly the same way, and no two people's addiction carries out the same way.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's multiple pathways to recovery. Mm-hmm. You don't have to recover the same way. You don't have to go to a MAR. You don't have to do yoga. You don't have to do high adventure. You can do whatever works for you. I do think there is one common essential for recovery.
Yeah.
I believe the opposite of addiction is connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there has to be some sort of connectivity. You got to get out of your head. You got to get out of the isolation and find at least one human to connect with, whether you call it human, a sponsor or a friend or a whatever you call them. I think there has to be a level of accountability on whatever pathway you want, as long as it's got integrity with you and your higher power also.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard it said before that there's as many paths to recovery as there are people on it.
Right.
And because even if you look at, you know, because there's so many different pathways to recovery these days, but you look at people who are on the same pathway to recovery and they still do it differently. Right. And they're still, you know, sober, they're still in recovery, they're, you know, whatever term you want to use for it. And it's, you know, if it's working, it's working.
Right. And that's one of those things about resources is I want people to understand you, again, as long as there's some integrity and you're straight with your higher power, there's no limit to what path, what way you can recover. And you should feel like, don't let somebody tell you there's only one way.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. There's whatever way you want to do it, as long as you're serious about it.
Yeah, that's like when people ask me, they're like, you do that program? Like, ooh, like, is that good? And I'll just be like, look, it's what works for me. Right. I tried the others. This one works. That's my opinion. That's my experience. Right. That's all I have.
Yeah, I think like there's still got to be some kind of boundary though, right?
Well, for me, the two main boundaries are you being straight with you and your higher power? And the way I define that is if you look in that mirror at night when you're by yourself, this. So for all the people that I lied to in active addiction, my wife, my son, employers, coworkers. I mean, I lied like most people breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I lied to myself 1,000 zillion times more than I did to everybody else. So when you stop lying to yourself and you're by yourself and you're like, okay, I say that my higher power is Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Are you straight with your higher power?
Right.
If you know you are, you're on the right track. And then I do strongly believe if there's some level of accountability with at least another human being from there, do what works for you.
I hear somebody in their mind going, is there a higher power that let me do drugs so I can stay in alignment with that higher power? Right. It might be a Hindu god
I don't know if the circle goes that far around. It may not.
No, but I love what you said, you know, about accountability with another person, because that's something like in my own recovery that's been difficult when it comes to the higher power aspect, because I don't, you know, follow the same practices as a lot of people in the South. And so when I'm feeling disconnected from my higher power, I'm like, well, who do I talk to? You know, because sometimes it is important, like, you know, we can say higher power, but sometimes I want to use the name I use, and other people want to use the name they use. Right. And it's like, you know, having at least one other person who understands, like, if I say the moon, if I say the goddess, you know, and they get it and they don't look at me sideways. And that's a very powerful connection to have with another human being.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the good news, bad news of our disease. So the federal government tells us that there's 29 million Americans in recovery today.
All right.
Well, That's good news, right? Yes, celebrate that. That's good news.
Yeah.
Of course, that means 29 million Americans have survived this hell on earth.
Right.
But we have survived. And so, you know, we throw this word diversity around a lot,
mm-hmm.
but there's diversity in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And then we use the technology. So maybe you that was a very diplomatic way to say that. Your higher power may not be the way it's done in the South the most, but that's cool. And goddess, whatever the goddess is to you, you're not alone.
Yeah.
There's somebody else out there, and it's really more than one somebody else.
Yeah.
And we have the ability now to use this social media that didn't exist when I started my active addiction. Yeah, this can be a tool for a lot of bad things, but mm-hmm. it can be a tool for very good things.
Mm-hmm.
And it connects us with people who, when we're not necessarily in the majority where we live geographically, we can find people who are in our tribe.
Yeah, that's been, you know, like having access to, you know, recovery content online, having access to spiritual content, having these resources in my pocket when I was new. Oh my God, that was so important, especially, you know, in between recovery meetings or, you know, after one that I didn't necessarily like, you know, having another resource to turn to and be like, okay, this fed my soul.
Yeah. Let me hear it said. In some ways, it's like everyone's saying the same thing. It's just, you just like it said the way that person says it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like when you kind of break everything down, mm-hmm. it all kind of gets to some fundamentals.
We're saying the same thing using different names.
Right. And a lot of the principles are still the same. Sure. You know, I think like I'm thinking of people who I think we can have this conversation, you know, like the all pathways thing. Right. I think like in any kind of pathway, right? There's positives and negatives, right? Some might say an abstinence model is too rigid, right? Because it sets up too high of a standard, and some might say harm reduction is too permissive, and it kind of sly. And so it's like, how does somebody kind of know, hey, I'm in recovery, if we don't have like a defined version of what that is?
Well, you know, I think the first barometer, again, it goes back to self-integrity.
Yeah.
I mean.
But can we ever be really self? I mean, like, you're talking to, you know, like,
no.
How do you know when you're lying to yourself?
Oh. It's like this famous Supreme Court judge said about pornography. I can't really tell you what it is legally, but I know it when I see it. I mean, you know, that's seriously what a Supreme Court justice was trying to explain about coming up to define a law. Look, it's hard to explain what integrity is, but you know it in your heart.
Yeah, it's like if you just stop for a second, sit down. It's like we intuitively can find it.
So I'll tell you a way I deal with it.
Yeah.
And this is a true story. So there I am at Mar, and I got arrested in October, so I checked into Mar a few weeks later in November, and then Christmas comes. And you can put in for these little mini weekends away from, you know.
Yeah.
So they let me go home at Christmas. Now, remember, Mar's over 50 years old, and you know me, I've been in treatment for just a few weeks. So I know all, and I know everything, right?
You're an expert, yeah.
I'm an expert. So they're at that point, they have my car brought to me, and here's your keys, and see you in 2 or 3 days, whatever it was. I leave Mar on Buford Highway at 285 in the heart of Metro Atlanta, driving past hotels I had done crack cocaine in.
Yeah.
I had to make a choice that night in the middle of treatment. Do I pull over or go see my family at Christmas? Now, this is a guy who one Christmas went on one of those binges at Christmas time.
Yeah.
I was making a choice in treatment.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I didn't understand what was going on.
Oh, watch the cameras there, buddy.
I just knew that I went home that night and made a choice.
Yeah.
Now, 7 years later, I drive all over Metro Atlanta, all over the United States. I don't care if there's a mile's worth of crack cocaine at that hotel. I know that I believe in my recovery for me. It's not for my wife. It's not for Jack.
Yeah.
It's not for a job. It's not for you guys. It's for me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I want to be in recovery because I want to be in recovery. I think we all know what we want because I acknowledge, and you're absolutely right, it's a great question. When I was trying to be abstinent in active addiction, I was still resentful that I couldn't do what I really secretly enjoyed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Recovery for me and the connection to my higher power, it transferred where my values are. So I have new things that I value as a human being. So I don't value the feeling that I got from crack. I value the feeling I get when I do something with Jack.
Right.
That's one way I know what that barometer is.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, we have more people coming into our own studio audience. The more the merrier.
You know, we're live streaming and the folks are just mobbing in. It's great.
Come on in. Once they heard Jeff was here.
Standing room only.
Somebody heard that there was a mile worth of crack.
I heard their pizza too. The pizza's here. The crack's not here.
You think it's Parmesan, here. Actually.
It's Parmesan.
Yeah. We thought it was Parmesan, but.
Yeah. No, I mean, I remember it's pretty profound that you were that early and drove by, because I remember that driving by those places and I could physically have a visceral reaction, get the bubble guts.
Yes.
You know, I have no intention of it. And being able to, Dean actually talks about this, and he talks about the being congruent, right? So what you think, what you say, how you feel, and how you act is all in alignment. Mm-hmm. And when that's in alignment, that's when things, you know, you're kind of in alignment with God or with the universe or the kingdom or whatever, right? There's something happening there when you're in alignment. And I think that's kind of what you're saying is, and that we have the innate ability to see that and to know that, especially once we stop using the substance that's kind of taking us out of our selves, right?
Well, and that's part of why, you know, I was mentored by some great peer leaders. And they kept saying over and over, you know, the opposite of addiction is connection. It's not sobriety. Mm-hmm. It's connection. And so connecting with who? Your higher power, your family, your friends, other peers.
Yourself.
Yourself. You know, all of a sudden, you're not going to Boston to check off a box saying you've been to Boston. Like you're experiencing what's going on while you're there. And you're making memories and having fun. And so you're connected with the world in a healthy way.
Yeah, you're not going through the motions.
You're not going through the motions.
Yeah, and it's like you said too, but you got to do that internal work, right?
Oh,
there's yeah. That, yeah.
I mean, I was so ill that so there's something in the big book that says, will the addict or alcoholic go to any length for their sobriety? Well, Mar set my wife down and me and said, if he's not done. He's done, but he's not ready. And they said he just needs to keep going to meetings for 2 more years on a structured program. Well, we're working middle class family. I mean, you know, we don't have a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. We were already in financial situations. And I thought for sure my wife was going to say, you guys are just insane. But she said, okay. And for the better part of 2 years, it didn't quite go 24 months, but for the better part of 2 years, I had this program that Mar set up for me, and I was accountable to my sponsor and to Mar. I basically went to meetings for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
which became a habit, by the way. Because then Mar was like, well, now it's time to go back to work. And I'm like, I don't want to go back to work. I like what I'm doing. This is great stuff.
Right.
And Mar made me do what became, in my mind, a second round of amends, only they weren't amends. They're like, you're going to go get a job back in your industry. Well, let me just say, one of my roommates is a heart surgeon, and he operates on hearts today, which to me, that's a big deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One was is a Delta pilot. He flies planes every day. Also a big deal job, because like other people's lives are in their hands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was convinced, still in very, 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 very early, you're just done with treatment, you're kind of entering recovery phase, that these people didn't know what they were talking about, that there was no place in government or politics or policy for the crackhead chief of staff. that just wouldn't fly.
Yeah.
So now I enter into a clinical depression and I get angry. And my sponsor and my wife basically say, you're going to make these phone calls. So I start calling people that I had met in my professional world, many of whom I had hired and given a job to.
Yeah.
And once they realized what I was calling for, which was a job for me, I heard no an awful lot of times.
Wow.
Mm. No, no, no. Or just no return phone call or whatever. One man said he would help me after dozens of no's.
Mm-hmm.
One man said he would help me. And that person introduced me, and I ended up going to work for the Georgia Council for Recovery. So I want people also to know this. You're going to encounter no's. You're going to encounter obstacles in early recovery. Don't quit believing, because one person, it just takes one person to believe in you.
Yeah.
And they can literally change your life the way this one person changed my life. And the person that changed my life, his name is Chris. His last name is Carr, and his job is he's the Attorney General of Georgia. Mm. And he said, I believe in you. And I barely knew him.
Wow. And you trusted the process, too.
I trusted the process.
Mm. Yeah, you had people telling what?
Chris Carr.
Chris Carr.
That's my fraternity brother.
There you go. Everybody knows Chris Carr.
The world gets smaller every day.
Everybody knows Chris Carr.
I really wanted you two to connect.
And
you trust the process, right? And that's hard to do, right? So that's part of like when you people say, this is what you need to do, and you go, okay, I'll do that.
Trusting the process, or as Doug Brushetmore says, surrendering, I think was the hardest part of the process for me. Listening to other men, in particular, at MAR, the counselors are men, listening to my roommates who are my seniors, surrendering and going, okay, my answer is not the right answer. And it's okay to listen to other guys. And it's okay to trust other guys. And it's okay to share your feelings with other guys. Tell your life story and open up and be vulnerable. That was absolutely the hardest thing I think I've done. But I'll tell anybody watching this episode, if you can be that strong and that humble, it'll save your life.
Yeah. So let's jump into, this has all been really good. Let's jump into what is the Georgia Council for Recovery?
The Georgia Council for Recovery is Georgia's exclusive statewide peer-led recovery community organization. And a peer-led community organization, the way I describe it is, you all know we've been talking about going to treatment. Everybody understands. You're in active addiction, you go to this treatment center.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's great. Well, what happens, and let's say you stay there for 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens on day 91? You're out of that bubble and you're in the real world again. So recovery community organizations, we have 44 of them in Georgia. These are places that exist to support you in your recovery part of the journey. There's no treatment there. There's no clinical people there. It's only peers that are there. It's always free. And there's programs there as important but maybe as boring as how to get your driver's license back and how to learn to apply for all that stuff that
open a bank account.
You need to know.
Like basic life
stuff. Basic stuff, but that's not at all what it really is. It's that's there. But it's a place you can come hang out, no charge. Sometimes they're going to go whitewater rafting. Sometimes they're going to a movie. Sometimes they're just doing something fun. But it is a place to sustain your recovery that is peer-led, peer-oriented, without any judgment.
Yeah.
And they're just amazing life-saving places. The council leads that group of 44 around the state. And the council does some other programs that I'm sure we can talk about in a minute for Georgia.
When was the first RCO? What year was that?
Well, the council itself is 24 years old. The RCO started roughly 15 years ago.
Okay. Do you know which the first one was?
I think the first one in Georgia. And I may be wrong. I'm going to get me in trouble with these folks. I can tell you, because I wasn't around when they started, but I know that some of our legacy ones are Divas Who Win in Athens, Coweta Forest in Noonan, Living Proof in Rome. These were some of the first ones.
Yeah. So this council gets together and says, we need to offer more support, more environments for people in recovery?
Absolutely. The council advocates and runs programs. So let me talk about the programs first, because I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. So the council actually runs the program for
So you keep saying council, and I'm thinking people in a bunch of big high chairs.
Star Wars.
It's not a star chamber, and it's not the Politburo.
The council is gathered. We are going to make some decisions today.
Yeah, that's great. And the people at the council watching this, they'll love that. Look, in the real world, the council is made up of a staff of I'm going to get the number wrong, but 30-ish, 40 people, every one of them appear in recovery. Everybody that works there is a brother or sister in recovery. Mm-hmm. So it's a peer-run organization. So it's not some important people. It's us. Yeah. It's just more of our brothers and sisters who are in a position to be of service in a professional capacity, to manage programs. They manage a couple of cool programs. One program is the RCOs themselves. The other is the CARES Academy. What is CARES? Certified Addiction Recovery Empowerment Specialist. This is a state certification that a peer can go to. Then they get the ability to go work in the professional workplace and bring that peer voice into the clinical setting or into any professional setting.
Yeah.
And that is growing by leaps and bounds. The way it's getting more and more competitive is more and more businesses want this certification there. So the Georgia Council runs that.
Yeah.
They run a very awesome pilot program for the state of Georgia in Northeast Georgia Medical Center, the main hospital in Gainesville, where we've inserted peers in two places in the hospital. One is the emergency department, and those peers can be men or women, and they're there working with protocols with the team in the ED. And that's great, and it's awesome. But to me, the one that is out of this world is we've got peers inserted in the NICU. Now, those are all female peers, and we've seen a historic success in the program. So a woman encounters law enforcement. She's pregnant. She gets taken to the hospital to be checked out before she goes to jail. In the old days, she was definitely going to jail. Under this program, under certain circumstances, she hasn't caused anybody else bodily harm or she didn't rob the store. But if the doctors and the peer specialist recommend that person needs medical care not to go to jail, now under Georgia law, the sheriff deputy that took her there, the officer, is going to go home that night. And that mom's going to stay in the NICU and have a chance to get better, and she's never going to go to jail. And we've seen the average stay in the NICU for a woman with alcohol use disorder or substance disorder average almost 30 days, and it's dropped below 10 days. That's saving millions of dollars for healthcare, but more importantly, is increasing the quality of life. So that's just a couple of the programs that the council does. The point is to bring the peer voice into every segment of our community and make sure that people hear us.
Yeah. Like a lot of states – I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
When you say, you know, placing peers in businesses, you didn't say treatment centers.
Oh, no. Clinical centers too.
So is it – when you say businesses, is it like that clinical setting or are there other businesses that are wanting
– More and more. It's both. And that's what we love is more and more businesses say, well, we want to have a peer on our staff at the barbecue restaurant with our HR department to help us understand how to be a recovery-friendly workplace.
Okay. See, that's like something – so I work for my parents part-time, and that's something they are inadvertently – like they inadvertently have done that with their company this whole time. They've just never known how to do it. And so now they're like – you know, they've hired me, and they're like, hey, can you help us?
Oh, absolutely. Look, when I worked for Governor Deal, I worked for the Governor's Office of Workforce Development. So the number one cost to a business – is hiring employees and then the retention thereof. So if you can transform your workplace to where your first reaction isn't, oh, we've heard there might be drugs, we're going to fire that person.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Delta Airlines is a great example, and they deserve a little bit of credit.
Delta's
very, very supportive of their employees. And we need more businesses to do that. And more are every day.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So this whole peer concept of actually bringing a peer in, and it lets that perspective be heard by the board of directors, by the HR department. And all of a sudden, Jay Cunningham at Superior Plumbing, big shout out to Jay. Jay's done a video, and so it's very public. Jay talks about how he goes out of his way to hire people who are in recovery, mm-hmm. that they make the best employees with the most integrity. And that's the kind of business leaders that we want to reach, is the ones that don't just tolerate us, mm-hmm. but go out of their way to hire people with our disease.
Yeah, and that's something, like, growing up, I got to watch my parents do that. Like, they would hire people straight out of prison, straight out of jail, straight out of treatment. You know, they would hire the unhirables.
Right.
And so, so then when I get in the real world, I'm like, oh, that's not normal. Like, oh, it is kind of hard to find a job.
Yeah, right.
No, and if I can't, so to that point, is it kind of normal? See, here's the sad truth to that. So, to get serious, really serious for a minute, the number one cause of death as we sit here and tape and live stream in America for Americans 18 to 45 is overdose.
Mm-hmm.
That's the number one cause of death. Now, what does 18 to 45 mean? That's basically the end of high school and college. That's new families, and that's the heart of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
That's the future of America, in other words.
Oh, shit.
And Buddy Carter, as a member of Congress from Savannah, Georgia, he reminds us that according to the federal government, the average every single day of the week, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, is 200 overdoses a day in America. Mm-hmm. Now, when I say that number, people go, well, okay, that's 200. Let me tell you what 200 is in the real world to us. That's a 737 plane crashing every single day.
Whoa.
Now, think about that. If we were doing this right now and phones started going off and a 737 crashed, we might take a moment of silence here right now and mm-hmm. pray for the families and the souls that were lost and families impacted. We'd say this is sad. If this was a three-day episode,
yeah.
Tomorrow, if it happened again, we'd go, well, that's kind of odd.
Yeah.
And on the third day of our little three-day episode,
yeah.
we'd say, wait a minute.
Yeah. Day four, we're going to be like, why the fuck these planes crashing?
What's going on? Someone needs to do something. Like, why is it Congress right. and the president taking action and Delta needs to give me my money back for that ticket? Because yeah. I'm not getting on that plane. And if Delta didn't give us our money back, we'd have Congress pass a law that said.
But that stat has been rising for a couple of years.
Oh, it's been rising and rising.
Yeah.
It was exacerbated by COVID. We're at the point now with our disease that we're not just another policy issue. We are an epidemic that has eclipsed COVID. And until we stop tolerating that 737 crashing every day and demand that not just government, but that businesses and that faith leaders and that education leaders completely change their posture towards dealing with this medical issue,
mm-hmm.
the plane's not only going to keep crashing, it's going to be a bigger plane.
Mm-hmm. When you put it in the perspective with the airplane, it's just
yeah.
like,
yeah, that hits. Yeah, right. For sure. I think that the peer thing is like a brilliant way of empowering people in recovery who want to do something, because there's some training involved.
Sure.
You learn how to listen, how to ask questions, how to hold space, how to navigate those kind of things. So you're not just kicking it, you know. You are just kicking it too, though, if you want to. Right?
All right, right, right.
And that's what's cool about the peer support, is that it's not bound by a lot of those like ethical boundaries that you would have with a licensed professional counselor or something, right? So you're able to approach life and live life on life's terms with people and connect with them in various different ways. But there's some training in it.
Right.
And so it's empowering this force of people to go out there to begin to combat this, right?
Well, you know, so from both a clinical and a policy, now, Governor Kemp did a proclamation, and he was gracious and strong enough in his proclamation to have the words under his signature saying there are a lot of important voices in this process, but the peer voice is the most important voice. Look, our clinical people save our lives, and law enforcement save our lives, and a lot of people save our lives. But with this disease, with its complexity of the brain and the emotions, from a policy and a healthcare point of view, we're never going to solve the problem until all the stakeholders understand that the true experts at the table are survivors, people with lived experience, peers. It's our voice that matters the most. Everybody else's voice matters, and we need them, and we want them working for us. But our voice is the voice that's going to make the difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so... let's talk about this recovery bus.
Sure.
So other than the fact that it's cool.
It's cool.
Okay. What's up with the bus? What's going on?
So the bus is a 45-foot mega rolling bus that is going to go all over Georgia this September. Every September, some may not know this, but every September, it's National Recovery Month. And we're blessed again because of the strong leadership. You got to give credit where credit's due. Governor Kemp is probably the most pro-addiction recovery governor in the United States. And he's put the money where his mouth is, and he can make a strong case for that. He has allowed Commissioner Kevin Tanner at DBHDD to give the funding for this bus. And we'll take this bus. We'll start on International Overdose Awareness Day every August 31st. We'll start that day,
mm-hmm.
a more solemn tone that day, at a ceremony in Gainesville. But we're going to go to 64 stops all over Georgia in September. Some will be proclamation stops where we stop and get a little recovery proclamation from the local leaders. Some will be these cool policy stops where we're for like 2 hours we talk about agriculture and recovery or education and recovery or faith and recovery or whatever and recovery.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do about 12 of those. But then we have these big shindig parties. We have a live band traveling with us, Black Line Reggae. Check them out on social media.
Same band from last year.
Same band, Eric and his crew. Eric's in long-term recovery.
That's
a lot of the band members are in recovery. And we just have these parties. And that's great to have a party, and it's great to have a proclamation stop and all that. But what this bus is doing is two things at one time. We're going into some communities where that stigma is still there. And I don't think we've said it yet tonight, but let me tell you what stigma really, really is. Stigma is a word we use in polite society for hate and discrimination.
Mm.
That's what stigma is.
Mm-hmm.
So we take this bus and we roll it into a community and say, we're done with stigma. Georgia supports recovery. Now, simultaneously, we have friends and allies all over the state, and we're reminding them that recovery is real.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got folks in active addiction who see the bus and they go, oh, it's okay. My favorite story from last year may well be this story.
Mm.
A lady got in touch with me. It's not hard to get in touch with me, by the way. But a lady got in touch with me and I didn't know her. And she innocently, her heart was totally in the right place. She said, okay, I'm in this county. I know you have an event tonight in this county. Can you swing by this place? Because this young lady is in active addiction, and I want her to go to the event. Well, I had to explain to her that
I can't that just kind of bus.
Take the
right.
But she said, okay, I understand. And she said, here's what I'm going to do. This is a working class lady. This isn't some rich lady. She spent over $150 round, both ways. For a young woman she didn't really know, she'd come in contact with through her church, but she felt it was on her heart that this young woman needed to see recovery.
Mm.
So they got her an Uber. She couldn't afford an Uber. Sent her to this event. Now, we all knew she was coming, and our local host at this point, we're on the lookout for her, and we're going to welcome her and receive her, and make sure we had some ladies to receive her so she felt, you know, comfortable. She came to this event, and then she went over and talked to some peers who were female about stuff. I wasn't a part of that conversation. And then the lady had prepaid for her. I don't know about, you know, all the ways she does the Uber, but that's the power of that bus. That one life, well, two lives were impacted.
Mm-hmm.
The woman that wanted to help the young lady and the young lady. And then the other lives that were blessed. There's stories like that all over the state from last time. And this bus, it changes. Here's what this bus does, and here's what peer-led recovery does. We save lives, we restore families, and we strengthen communities. that's what this whole thing about recovery advocacy is all about. And that's what this bus does in a way that so few things can do.
Yeah. And I imagine it's also cauterizing communities, connecting people.
Oh, yeah.
People who can
become
great. It's
the ultimate connection.
Yeah. People can become great partners and resources, say, and they meet at one of these gatherings and go, oh, you do that? Well, I needed somebody who could do that. And so the more that you're kind of out there and showing up.
Right.
Right. And having this flagship that's showing up.
Right.
And people understand that.
I do want y'all to know there's one rule about the bus, though.
Oh, boy. No pooping on the bus?
Well,
oh,
no, man. That's no, that is allowed, apparently. It has a bathroom. They do need to be changed regularly. No, I'm not allowed to drive the bus, which I thought was a bummer. But apparently, the State Patrol has been alerted, and I'm not allowed to drive
the bus. You're not allowed to drive the bus. That's the only rule that you know.
The only rule I really know.
Yeah. Okay, so... let's talk about this. What, and as we're kind of wrapping up, what do you think, just from all your experience, right, in policy, in government, and then also in your service here at the Georgia Council, what do you think Georgia's unique challenges are when it comes to creating lasting systems to help Georgians recover?
So to answer that question, I got to explain something.
Okay.
Georgia is the biggest state land-wise east of the Mississippi River. Not population-wise, but land-wise. We're bigger than Florida, Pennsylvania, New York, all in the east. So we are a big place, and that is the heart of our biggest challenge. It is very difficult for people who live their entire life in metro Atlanta to understand the scope of geography of our state. So you get outside of metro Atlanta, and you talk to people, peers, providing services for mental health and addiction. The number one challenge is transportation. Because in Atlanta, somebody will say, oh, we got a meeting down at Americus. That's Southwest Georgia. Yeah, well, to the person living in Leesburg, one county over, might as well be Pluto. Because there's no MARTA and there's no Uber. So transportation for people outside of metro Atlanta, getting the services they need for treatment and long-term recovery is a very serious challenge.
Yeah.
Now, going right hand in glove with that, is internet connectivity. So we say up here in Atlanta, well, we can put broadband in and people can telehealth and telecommute. Well, that's great right here in metro Atlanta, but I have personally been shown by leaders and communities outside of metro Atlanta how there's just no internet. So we have to get real about how big our state is and how diverse the needs are outside of metro Atlanta and really understand the biggest industry in our state, the thing that most Georgia families make their living on is agriculture. So all this fancy stuff we have in metro Atlanta with the Deltas and the Cokes and the UPS, that's all great. And those families are important too. But agriculture dwarfs all the other industries. And what's going in agriculture today?
I had no idea that.
Oh, absolutely. And here's what's going on in agriculture today. Suicide rates are at a historic high among farmers. So Commissioner Tanner is taking the lead, working with Agriculture Secretary Tyler Harper, and they're working on ways to get mental health and addiction programs into our agriculture community. Because unfortunately, we're losing too many farming family members. Yeah. So that's another unique thing is how do we deal with the economic reality that's hitting that industry? And then men and women in the industry get desperate. They turn to drugs and alcohol. That leads to shame. It leads to suicide.
And there's no resources. They're in rural areas.
Right.
There's lack of resources.
So right off top of the bat, those are some things that we've got to get serious about. One more thing. As great as Georgia is doing with our policy on mental health and addiction, what I need everybody here to hear is we still have those that oppose us in government and business, and we need your voice. We need you to speak up. You know, the council, we do a lot of advocacy work in local communities, and we need you to help join us so that we can make the case to our members of Congress, to our members of the General Assembly, that we need more funding so that maybe a place like Most High Media can apply for a grant because we're reaching people on the issue killing more people than anything else in America. Well, the money's there to get. We just have to organize like our friends in the AIDS community have organized, like our friends in the cancer community have organized. everybody knows what the pink ribbon means every October. Right. That's for everybody knows it's for breast cancer.
Yeah.
Susan G. Komen, a group of people impacted by cancer, came together and said, enough. We're going to change the culture in America around cancer. It's up to us as peers who have been blessed to survive this disease and family members to unite our voice and say, we're going to go tell our elected officials, tell our businesses, what are you doing to sponsor, fund, pass laws, change rules so that people at our community can thrive?
Yeah, well said, man. Yeah. The rural component is it's a complex one. That's one thing that we've been working on behind the scenes. We're trying to develop some things on how can we reach people. During COVID, I mean, we had like a very impactful year that year because everything shut down and we're in online media streaming and we would do these all recovery meetings. And it ended up after that we had all this, we have this community now, Florida and Texas and Seattle and Philadelphia, you know, because we had all connected.
Right.
But you're right on the, like, what we kind of see internet almost as a utility and necessary thing, like electricity. It's like you're not really moved in until the internet's connected, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but to even imagine, oh, there are vast areas of this state where there isn't any internet or the cell service is really bad. And so to access resources, and then how do they know to access resources if they did have the broadband, right? So it's a pretty complex issue. So thank you for framing it that way. Yeah. Anything you think you want to say or anything that's unsaid that you feel like you want to say before we wrap it up?
Well, I should say this, and I'll repeat it twice, and maybe you guys can stream it later or something, but there is a resource out there that is peer-led. It's free, it's safe, it's confidential, and it's not it can be a crisis line, but it's called the CARES Warm Line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 844-326-5400. I'll say it again in a second. So it's a place you can call up if you're in active addiction and you're wondering about recovery. No clinical people, no law enforcement, just peers. Or you're in recovery. I can't afford to go to a see a psychiatrist. I just need somebody to talk to, but I don't even want to talk to a clinician. There's peers. They're there to listen.
Yeah.
Now maybe you're a family member and you don't know where to get a resource. Call the CARES Warm Line, 844-326-5400. Your tax dollars pay for it. The Georgia Council staffs it for DBHTD. It is one of the greatest resources the state has. There is another new one. I do want to take advantage of a few more moments and say this.
Yeah, do it.
And it's even simpler to call, 988.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's the new nationwide mental health suicide addiction line being stood up, and DBHTD, once again, Commissioner Kevin Tanner taking the lead on something in Georgia. Look, 911, we all know what it is, but it started a number of decades ago, and I've sat through some lessons on how they started it. It took a while to start it. It wasn't like they flipped a switch one day and everybody in America knew what it was and it worked perfectly. 988 is active in Georgia. So check this out. There's a scene that goes down and you either don't want to call 911 because, or maybe you know perfectly well, you just don't need to call 911, but you need some help. Well, that's the whole point of 988.
Mm-hmm.
A crisis response team of medical people will be dispatched.
Yeah.
And maybe law enforcement too, but here's the deal. When the crisis people get there, and again, now you haven't robbed 20 stores or anything like that, but they're like, the cop's going to go, I'm out of here. And now you're going to be in a medical protocol, not a law enforcement. So if you can trust 988, and if you need 988, call 988.
Now, 988's a federal?
It's nationwide.
Yeah.
But it's administered in each state.
Okay.
By a state
and then
agency.
The crisis response units, is that part of 988?
That's part of, we have two of those. Yes, there's crisis response teams for 988, but also because of a House bill we passed, ironically called House Bill 1013, in Georgia. Trust me, we've all done that.
Got that.
We got it? Okay. But
not forgetting that one.
I know, right? It's easy. And you, look, but it's fun to joke about. But that's a big deal bill for us. And part of this 74-page bill created in Georgia law, crisis response teams for police departments and sheriff's department, any law enforcement agency. And officers have to now, under law, go through crisis training. And it's going to be uniform crisis training, so it's the same statewide. Again, it's a new program, and some veteran officers may haven't got, you know, but every new hire is going through this training, and eventually the veterans are going to go through it. But I've met chiefs and sheriffs all over the state. I'm blessed to get to meet, and I've met a lot of ranking. I was with a rank-and-file police officer this past Saturday at the NAMI office. He is a lieutenant in the Brookhaven Police Department, African-American lieutenant, puts his life on the line every day. I mean, he's just a guy doing his job. And he said the whole culture in the Brookhaven Police Department has changed. He said nobody wants to send people to jail, but nobody had ever taught us how to respond in a crisis situation. Mm. We also don't want to die that day.
Right.
But he said, now we've been educated and we're learning. And he said, people may not trust officers, and we get that. But he said, believe me when I tell you the culture's changing in law enforcement. And I do believe that.
Yeah.
So there's always going to be some bad apples. I get that. Yeah. But my message...
Well, we talked about that last episode. Yeah. That we had an experience with the local police department, and they responded, and it was a mental health crisis, and they didn't escalate. They were fantastic at it. So that was why I was
wondering.
So we
got those crisis teams too. So things really are. If we're in the midst of a historic epidemic of deaths, and we are, we're also in the midst where we get to a front row seat in our state of a state that has made a commitment to change the way we do both mental health and addiction. And we have a chance, all of us in this room and all of us watching this live stream. If you have an idea of something that's not being done that should be done, and it's a serious idea,
yeah,
you contact somebody like me. We've got a caucus in the General Assembly,
mm-hmm.
the Mental Health Caucus. We've got the Working Group on Addiction and Recovery in the General Assembly. We're the only state in the nation that has an addiction group and a mental health caucus. We've got representatives that have literally introduced bills that were the idea of families and peers.
Yeah.
So we have a chance. And so get involved. And if you're not happy, help be a part of the change.
Man. Thanks, Jeff. Brother, that was really good, man. Thank you for being on the show, Jeff. Thank you for all the work you do and for kind of connecting the dots so eloquently for us. And,
well, let me say thank you for this platform, the work Most High Media is doing around our state to be the Netflix of recovery, to get the word out. You guys are saving lives, and you guys are helping restore families and strengthen our community. So thank you and your entire team for the leadership y'all do. It's recognized, and it's making a difference.
Amen. Thanks, brother. All right, this has been an episode of The Most High Show. Peace.
Excellent.
Okay.
Good. I love that.
That was great.
Yeah.
That was amazing. That was great. Good stuff. Yeah.